The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Sunday Space Show. Thank you for tuning in. It's great to be here. A beautiful day in the San Francisco area. I hope wherever you are, it is equally as nice. A couple of quick announcements. You can call our program today and talk with our guest. That toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Let the phone ring until it can be answered, and we'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. If you would like to use Skype, remember it's computer to computer with a headset, and the ID is one word, The Space Show. And if you would like to still use email, which most of you seem to prefer, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Do please remember that we're copyrighted and trademarked, but you can download the MP3s of these programs, and you can put them on a DVD or a CD or memory stick or circulate them to help get the word out as to why space is important to all of us. Please don't do anything commercial with the programs. Please don't edit the programs. No private YouTube channels, for example. And written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. We do podcast, and we thank Andrew over at gigadial.net for our podcasting service. And you can find the RSS URL to subscribe to our podcast on our website, both of our newsletters. And then we're also in iTunes, Podcast Alley, Microsoft, Zune, AstroSpaceNow.com, YAstro.com, and a host of other places. If you have any podcasting issues, I will do my best to respond to you. We're still hoping to get some answers for Daniel with his droid question that he raised on the Open Lines program a week ago. Any of you out there encountering podcast issues on a droid, we'd love to hear from you, especially if you can help solve the problems that we brought up last week. Let me also tell you that go to our website, thespaceshow.com. You'll find the comprehensive newsletter. It is uploaded every Sunday evening. It has all of the guest bio information, the program information, and it's the only place you'll find a future event section for the Space Show. And we're already going into next year, 2012. If we have to make announcements or change the schedule, this is where you'll find it first. You can also find the pop-up window and the information to subscribe to our very short email newsletter that goes out early Monday morning, California time. Everything that we have done since 2001 is archived and available off of our website. You can download these shows, or you can listen right off of our site. There is a Space Show store. You'll see up near the top it says Space Show Gear, and then you'll see the Support the Space Show. Remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, and this program only exists because of your generous contributions. We thank all of you who have contributed and who will contribute. And do remember, if you're paying United States taxes, you get a tax deduction from the IRS. If you pay California taxes, you also get a California deduction, as we are a California public benefit corporation. And do remember, finally, that we are brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation. They help to promote cooperative solutions for space security. For more information and to see the type of programming they're involved with, which is unbelievable and outstanding, visit their website, SecureWorldFoundation.org. And that brings me to our guest today, and I'm happy to bring back to the Space Show Dr. Joan Vernikos. Dr. Vernikos is a pioneering medical research scientist who has conducted seminal studies in space medicine, inactivity physiology, stress and healthy aging. She was also, believe it or not, she was at NASA, and she was the director of NASA's Life Science Division. And she really understands microgravity and what it does to people in space, as well as translating all of that information and using it to benefit people on Earth. In her research at NASA, she spearheaded groundbreaking medical studies on the effect of weightlessness on health. Her NASA research on the health effects of weightlessness have helped establish the scientific causal relationship between sedentary living, rapid aging, and poor health. And she has a brand new book out that we're going to be talking about, and I really urge all of you to get this book. It's called Sitting Kills, Moving Heals, How Simple Everyday Movement Will Prevent Pain, Illness, and Early Death, and Exercise Alone Won't. And again, this is all based on her work and experience and knowledge of microgravity, weightless studies. And, well, I'll let Dr. Vernicles tell you more about it. Welcome back to the program. How are you today?
I am very well, David. Thank you very much for having me back.
Always a pleasure, always an honor to talk to you. I guess let's start with NASA and space and what we know for real about the effects of weightlessness and microgravity. I know many listeners will say, old hat, we already know that, but maybe you wouldn't be surprised, but maybe you would be. A substantial number of space show listeners and people out there really believe that, A, the microgravity problems are totally solved, and, two, we can kind of blow them off, and we could even go to Mars today, and, you know, all we have to do is spin at some rate, maybe, you know, Earth 1G or something, and we'll just be hunky-dory with artificial gravity or something like that. What is the status of all of this today, and then let's apply it to us here on Earth?
Well, David, I think it's very important to point out that we don't have the answers or the solutions to keeping people healthy in space for a long time. We have had now a number of astronauts who have spent 6 months on the International Space Station, so that the data that is coming in is solid. It is not just the odd observation here and there. And the gist of it is that two things. One, we have focused on preventing the effect of microgravity or space with exercise. It's been a monolithic approach to using more and better exercise to try and prevent the effects of space. First of all, we've never flown an astronaut who did not exercise, so we don't really know how bad things would be without it. There's no doubt exercise does help. A lot of exercise is needed. Hours and hours of exercise are needed to make any difference at all. But the long and the short of it is, it doesn't matter how much exercise you apply, you cannot totally prevent the effects of space flight. That's a very important point, at least with the techniques we've used so far. Okay. We have not spun anybody in space because we haven't had anything spinning in space. And that's a whole different issue. It is possible that by having a centrifuge in flight, we might be able to protect some systems some of the time, or for short periods. We don't know. That research has not been done. That research was started and stopped and started and stopped innumerable times. So it was never followed consistently to be able to establish whether it does or doesn't. Makes sense that it would, but what is the exact recipe is a different issue. We have interpreted the role of gravity as we know it on Earth. Of course, it surrounds us. And I remember in my early days talking to my colleagues about studying the effects of gravity, and they said, well, what's the problem? I said, well, you know, we go into space and it's not absent, but it is much reduced. And they said, well, you know, here on Earth doesn't make any difference. I said, well, we don't know until we get away from it. And sure enough, we've learned an awful lot by observing astronauts in space. The other thing is that we have made the assumption that when astronauts return, they automatically recover. And they recover, jump right back to where they were before they left. Now, these are very, very healthy specimens. So let's not forget that. And we're talking here about the right stuff. We're talking about extremely healthy individuals who exercise and have an active life. And then you put them in space, and they come back, and they used to recover right away. In fact, nobody bothered in the U.S. Space program with too much focus on rehabilitation and recovery, unlike the Russians, who really have emphasized that a great deal. But now that they've been up there for 6 months, it's a different story. And with better techniques of scanning technology for bones and measurements of muscle and other criteria, it is not such a simple business. The recovery is not such a simple, as simple as we thought. Can I say that they've gone and they have not recovered? I cannot yet ask NASA what they, you know, but because some do, some don't. Some recover faster than others. Some have not recovered, even 2 years later. So that is a second issue. The third issue, which is the most important, really, finding, is that with these 6 months, we have been able to establish the rate of change that occurs in various body systems in space. And we also know that here on Earth, from, say, age 20 on, there is a downward slope. Slippery slope does not start at 60, 70, 80. It starts at 20. Let's make that very clear. We're not just talking about the old folks. We're talking about from the time you stop developing and you go to college and start sitting and are less active, perhaps, because you're studying or for other reasons, whatever they are, or you then sit in front of your computer or you go to a job and equally sit in front of the computer or the television set or whichever. There is a standard curve that's been described of the rate of loss of bone or loss of muscle and metabolic changes, increasing difficulty in controlling blood sugar and so on. Well, the rate of change in space is 5 to 10 times faster than it is on Earth in the natural process of aging. And this is extremely interesting and important because although we have gravity here, we see this decline in spite of the being surrounded by gravity. In space with probably gravity below the threshold that is needed to have an effect. It happens extremely fast. So what they've been seeing is bone loss in 6 months in one person of 30%. Now, 30% loss of bone is serious. I don't care who you are, what you think. 30% loss of bone is extremely serious. And we're talking 6 months.
Where does the bone loss go? I mean, do the bones shrink up? What happens if you're losing 30% of your mass of your bone?
You're losing the calcium from the bone, from the matrix of the bone, and so the density of the bone becomes less, and the calcium is eventually excreted. And of course, they have a tendency for kidney stones, which is not a fun thing to have in space. Anywhere, but in space in particular. There's always that concern that the increased loss of calcium, you know, can be translated into kidney stones. But, so the calcium is lost from the bone, and sometimes it gets into other tissue. We have not seen that, or at least I'm not aware of it, But it does get out through the urine.
So here's what I don't understand, and maybe you can answer it, maybe you can't, but it seems to me that to even be talking about long-duration human spaceflight when we can't address the most basic issues that you're talking about today on the safety of the crew for being up there 6 months or longer, it just seems to me like the whole discussion is unfocused and premature. And why wouldn't there be an intense amount of energy put on addressing and resolving this particular issue if we really someday do intend to have humans in space for a long time or to go to Mars or to do anything? And if people are just blowing off and discounting what you and others are saying, then how safe could our plans be for long-duration human spaceflight?
Well, you're absolutely right. On the other hand, we shouldn't be paralyzed by the fact that we have a problem.
Right, but we need to solve it.
But we need to solve the problem. And there are a variety of ways of going about it. One is to say, well, look, what we've done hasn't worked absolutely. We're flogging a dead horse, perhaps. Maybe there are other ways. Maybe we should investigate artificial gravity, which I personally believe should work. Depends how you use it. And that's a separate subject.
Are there pills or medication interferences that would somehow be developed to counter all of this?
Yes, there are pills, as you know, for bone loss that women take, and men as well, but women mostly take. But it is very hard to take a healthy person and give them medication that causes a semi-permanent effect. Now, they're talking about giving astronauts drugs that prevent bone loss. But it basically is like cement. It cements the bone. And so it prevents the bone from its normal formation and breakdown cycle. It interferes with that.
So Joan, I recently met a crew of one of the last two shuttle flights. I don't want to go any more into that because of what I was told. I was asking them about, and this was one-on-one at a private affair, and I was asking them about the microgravity issues. And so he said, we have it pretty lit. We take biphosphonates, which are the pills you're talking about.
Yeah. I didn't know that, but that's what they were talking about, giving them.
Yeah, and I said, well, how can you say that licks the program? Because I understand that women and people who take these drugs have horrible side effects and risks from them. And he says, we're only taking them for a very short time versus what a person on Earth would take them for osteoporosis. So the side effects don't really have a lot of time to mount up on us, and we'd stop taking them when we return from our mission. So that's the answer I got to that. And, you know, that doesn't address a long-duration flight. That addresses going up on the shuttle and the space station.
It's palliative. It's short-term palliative, and at least there is a drug out there that, you know, can potentially help prevent some of the loss. How the bone recovers afterwards, after they stop taking it, I have no idea. I don't think anyone really knows or has studied long enough.
No, I think they'd need to do long-term studies of the people who took it to see what it did to them.
Exactly. And all its potential side effects that's known from clinical studies of people who take it chronically, because they may need to take it later during the rehabilitation. I don't know. But it is a solution. It is a solution for the bone, but it's by no means a solution for all the other systems.
So you did when you were at NASA, and I guess continuing to today, they do quite a bit of bed rest study to try to affect and see what's going on with weightlessness. Does that still go on today?
Yes, that's very much the model, both the European Space Agency, the Japanese, the Russians, and we, and I assume the Chinese, are using bed rest. That is a very, very good model, especially slight inclination with the head lower than the feet. And you know how that came about, don't you? A Russian cosmonaut came back from space and complained that he couldn't get a decent night's sleep when he got back. And the scientist said, well, what do you do? He said, well, I can get sleep if I raise the foot of the bed by about, you know, putting some phone books under the feet of the bed. Until every night I lower the bed a little bit, until it's horizontal again. And the scientist thought immediately that that angle with the head down, slightly down, must be closer to space flight than just lying in bed, horizontal. And that's how the model was developed, first by the Russians, and then we imported it into the U.S. It is a very good model, and very closely mimics the effect that you see in spaceflight. And you can study what can prevent the changes, and how, especially how you recover. And we haven't done enough work on rehabilitation. And I think that's very important.
So if you're, let's say you're sick and you're in the hospital for 3 months, you know, your muscles start to atrophy, right?
Right.
So is this part of the weightless effect, or is this something else?
No, it's this effect. It's exactly the same. And, you know, they started getting you out of bed sooner. Now, they get you out of bed as soon as they can.
Right, to get you to just sit up sometimes is really hard to do.
To sit up or to take a little walk or whatever. And that was encouraged to a great extent by the insurance companies, because they want people to get out of the hospital as quickly as possible. And we were doing this research and saying, hey, folks, you know, we're taking healthy people and we're making them sick by lying in bed. And pay attention. So it's a very, very significant physiological factor that we're dealing with here. That you can induce all these changes, and you know, you talked about the book earlier, but I have a chapter and tables of the list of things that happen. I mean, it's not just bone and muscle. That's what we've heard and we know. But it's all the whole equilibrium, balance, and coordination system. It's the blood pressure regulation. It is red cells. It is the immune system. It is the hormones. It's the metabolism in general. It's the absorption of anything, food and drugs, from the gut. It is how the kidney functions, how the liver functions, how the eyes, now they're noticing, or at least they're admitting, that they have problems with their vision. And it goes on and on and on. The skin, the joints, it's a very comprehensive change that happens. Every system in the body is affected. And the way our medical practice and education is set up is so segregated into disciplines and systems that we rarely look at the whole body. I mean, yes, we were beginning to. Places like the Mayo Clinic and Duke and a place up in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, where the doctors work together on a patient and talk to each other. Otherwise, people go to a doctor, we have one problem, they give them one pill, they go to another doctor, you know, they complain of another problem that is a consequence of part of the same thing. They get another pill and so on and so forth. Never the doctors talk to each other. And they end up with 10 pills a day. So here we have a normal human body, a healthy, a magnificently healthy human body. And all we do to it is make it spend 24 hours a day in bed. And you see, what happened is that the assumption has been that what you remove, what you take away, is activity. And so the logical thing was to replace activity. Well, that's the exercise that is replaced with it. The other aspect that someone said, yes, but when you're dealing with bone, it's the loading effect. You know, your weight is a function of gravity. If you are weight less in microgravity in space, you're not loaded. The body's not loaded. So that's a function of gravity. Well, okay. So you can introduce load, but there's more to it than that. And what we found, in fact, the last study I ever did at NASA, our research, was to ask the question, well, if I'm lying in bed 24 hours a day, and I get all these changes, and if I'm up and about and I don't get the changes, what's the minimum amount of time I need to be up and about to prevent these changes occurring in 24 hours? And so we had subjects come and lie in bed, and we did a study where we had them come back repeatedly at monthly intervals. And we had them stand up by the every hour on the hour during the day. So they stood up for eight times or 16 times. And they stood for 15 minutes. I believe you don't need to stand up for 15 minutes. You can just stand up for 3 minutes. Or I don't know. Nobody's done it. But the longer you stand, other systems come in and interfere. In other words, your muscles start contracting. If you stand continuously, your muscles start contracting and pumping blood up and so on. Whereas if you just change position, that is the signal that is the gravity signal, change signal, that the body sees, the body recognizes. And the body responds, whether it's a nervous system or it's bone or muscle, what it is, it responds to change, it responds to on-off switch. So if I stand up and stay standing for 4 hours, 2 hours during the day versus standing up every hour on the hour for 16 times or 15 minutes each, it is not equivalent. The 16 hours change of posture prevents all the effects that are induced by being in bed 24 hours a day, whereas standing up for 4 hours, the body sees it only as one change.
So 15 minutes every hour that you're awake changing is more beneficial.
Oh, yes. And it doesn't have to be 15. It can be much less. If you can just stand up for a couple of minutes and sit down again. Because sitting down is important, too. And that is one of my recent observations. You know, think about it standing up. Well, obviously, you stand up, you have to sit down. And there's been a lot of research recently about the hazards of sitting. And that sitting induces changes that no one was aware of before. Well, sitting for a long time is just as bad as standing for a long time. And we know standing for a long time, you can get, blood pooling, you can feel faint, all kinds of things. So it is the change in signal, the change in posture, that's the best possible use of gravity.
So the astronauts move around a lot, but because they're weightless, these right. signals are masked. Is that, or just
yes.
not there? Is that the...
There is nothing. A change in position doesn't register anything. There is no response. The body does not see the stimulus. Because what's happening is when you stand up, your body is pulled downwards toward the center of the Earth by gravity. And so the blood pools to your feet, your heart has to pump harder, and your blood vessels have to pump to send the blood up to your head, or you'll pass out. And so it is exercising the whole system just by responding to that simple, to that very simple stimulus.
We're at the bottom of the hour. Let's take our first pause. And when we come back, let's take a look at your book, Sitting Kills, Moving Heals, because you've applied what you know from all of this NASA work and the weightlessness work to more than just getting up every 30 minutes or every hour from our chairs here on Earth. And let's talk about some of that. I mean, people always say, you know, what are the payoffs, if there are any, for human spaceflight? This would seem to me to be a huge payoff that probably should be discussed and talked about far more often and more frequently than what it is. So, listeners, stay where you are, and we'll be back in 3 minutes with our guest today, Dr. Joan Wernicke.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And good afternoon, everybody, and welcome back to the second part of our discussion today with Dr. Wernicke. And we're talking about her book, Sitting Kills, Moving Heals, How Simple Everyday Movement Will Prevent Pain, Illness, and Early Death, and Exercise Alone Won't. And this is all stemming from her work in NASA's Life Science Division and her ongoing work on the study of microgravity and what it does in weightlessness to humans, which is far more comprehensive than what we typically talk about on The Space Show, and I would venture to say most of us understand. During the break, Joan, you were talking to me about the impact and effects of all of this on brain and coordination. It's not just a bone issue, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The brain, first of all, we know very little about how microgravity affects the brain. We had a dedicated mission called NeuroLab, which was to study specifically how the nervous system is affected, and it was a wonderful mission, probably the best life sciences mission and the last one in research that we did on the shuttle. But we've known for a long time that when astronauts come back, they suffer from poor coordination and equilibrium. And it takes some time to recover that. It takes about a day for day. And in other words, a day of space for a day to recover. With longer stays in space, it takes longer to recover. And it's but it's extremely important, because what neuroscientists are describing now, brain scientists, is that we form maps of our surroundings. So that you know that if you're driving someplace, you go back and you know exactly if you turn at a certain place, you'll be under, you know, where you wanted to be. Your system works and tells you that. In the same way, if you walk around, you automatically avoid steps or things you don't run into. Well, what happens in space is that there is no information coming of your sense of direction. You lose it, and therefore these maps start fading. And when you return, you have to relearn how to... you have to... those maps have to be reformed, etched, I call it, re-etched. You have to etch these maps in your brain so that, you know, you can function in your surroundings. And it's critical not only just to do it to etch these maps or to restore these maps in astronauts when they return, but us, as we age, we have to be constantly reinforcing these maps so that we don't lose our balance and we don't lose our coordination.
This is your first question from Joe, is in Houston. And Joe says, I have family relatives that are doctors, MDs, internal medicine specialists, and one of them is an orthopod. And I'm curious to know why they never, ever talk about lessons learned from space with their patients or with us in the family, or giving us advice, or seeing some of the things we do and maybe commenting on it. I've not heard from them the kind of information I'm hearing from you. Is this widely known in the general medical field, or is this only known within the space medical field? Well, how do you explain this?
Well, it is well known within the space medical field. It is obviously known among the astronauts who have been in space, the experiences. What the general medical community probably do not know much about it, because there are scientific papers published in scientific literature, and what happens is that something that has to do with the brain is published in a journal called Brain Research, something that has to do with bone is published in Bone, and so on. So it is not something that is understood. It's not well known. let me just put it bluntly. It is not well known about the practicing medical community. Now, I left NASA right after Glenn's flight, John Glenn's flight. I left NASA in 2000, and I left NASA because during the John Glenn mission, the return of John Glenn to flight, my job as director of life sciences was to go out and speak and talk to people about the flight and about John Glenn being a senior, going back into flight at age 77. And I did a lot of public speaking. And what struck me was that at the end of my talks, people would come up and say, where can I find out more about this? Where can I read about this? And my jaw would drop, because I had no idea where to send them. Yes, there is a textbook of aerospace medicine. Okay? And yes, there are plenty of scientific publications. But for the lay person, there was nothing. And I thought, you know, this is criminal. How can I go around and continue talking when I constantly have this question at the end. I should sit down and write something. Well, you know, with the craziness of NASA headquarters and politics and all that, I didn't have much time to do it. So I decided, this is what I'll do. My next career will be to get out there and talk to people and tell them what happens in space. And I started off thinking that I'd write a report or something in a year, and it took me 4 years for my first book. And it's almost 10 years, I hate to tell you, for this one, because it's so difficult to get it, well, publishing being what it is. I'm well known in the scientific literature, but I'm not a household word in the lay audience. But I've been an N of one going around talking about this. I don't know anyone else who does. I honestly do not know anyone who goes around doing public speaking to the lay audience, to the general public. So that's what I do. And now I have, you know, my website, I have a newsletter, I have a blog. I'm trying to get the word out there. And I hope this book, which is much more, you know, as a scientist, it's hard to communicate in simple language. I can do it verbally, but the minute you put a pencil in my hand, I revert to the technical jargon. And so I've had to really relearn how to write for the general public and simplify and simplify and simplify without compromising what I'm saying.
Have you ever made a keynote to the AMA convention where there are thousands of doctors?
No.
And they probably wouldn't think of doing this, would they?
No.
You have a caller on hold. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
This is John, Atlanta.
Hi, John. Welcome to the show, and go ahead and talk to Dr. Vernikos.
Yes. This has a lot of implications for future space operations. And I noticed that there's, you have two schools of thought. When we talk about human factors, we get into some very negative things. On the other hand, the other side of it, everybody's talking about, you know, colonizing the moon or missions to Mars and so forth. And I'm wondering, we know about zero gravity, and we know about Earth gravity, but do we have any idea, thoughts on what would happen at levels like 1/6 gravity or roughly 38% of Earth's gravity?
We don't know except what we've seen from Apollo missions. In other words, if you watch film, photographs, images from the astronauts, the Apollo astronauts, you can see first they're upright. They hop, they don't walk, but they are upright. And that in itself says that the 1/6 G has some effect. It is sensed. Is it totally adequate to prevent the changes? Probably not. I would expect that there will be slower development. I don't know what it would do to things like sleep, for instance, which is a very interesting. I mean, we think of sleep as something that, after all, you're lying down when you sleep, right?
Yeah.
Well, you're lying down in 1/6 G. I don't know if it's going to be the same as lying down in 1 G. I think there is sufficient gravity on the moon and on Mars to prevent some of the changes. You'll get some directional input, which is good, and together with wearing a heavy spacesuit and a backpack, it might be enough to compensate or retard some of the effects. But you still have to get there and come back.
Like on Mars, I guess with a spacesuit and equipment, you would be getting a lot closer.
Yes.
Whereas the moon would still be. I guess in space, then you're forced on using centrifugal force then to try to compensate by a spinning approach.
I am in favor of studying artificial gravity, or at least providing it, but it's not like, you know, most people talk about you hop on the centrifuge for half an hour or an hour, and that's supposed to prevent all the changes. No. You have to understand what it is, how the body perceives gravity here on Earth, how we use it, and what is it that is removed when you're away from it. And we haven't done that. And if you stop and think about it, we move about in gravity. We sit, we stand, we bend, we run, we accelerate, we stop. We put our heads down, we put our feet up. We lie down when we sleep. And there is all that variety, which just spinning for half an hour is not going to do it. In the same way as I don't think half an hour, it doesn't make sense that half an hour of exercise.
That kind of forces you into something like a fairly large spacecraft to have enough so the Coriolis effects aren't too pronounced, I guess. That gives us another problem then. If you had to have permanent rotation almost when you're in space.
What about those who say we can go to Mars and all we have to do is spin at Martian gravity? There's, I guess, no evidence that that's sufficient or effective, right?
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
John, what else?
I guess that's the basic thing I was wanting to kind of discuss is, you'd have to have a fairly large spacecraft, you would think, in order to be able to actually sustain continuous rotation.
Continuous rotation is a whole different issue.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, you could have a larger spacecraft, and I think you can get away with an onboard centrifuge as long as, you know, it has a radius that's like, say, 2 meters. To cover an average person, but it has to be something, in my view, that an astronaut can hop on and off many times during the day.
Mm.
Because if he or she spins for 30 minutes or an hour, when it stops, he's not back in one gravity like he would be on the ground on Earth. He's back in microgravity. And we know that within hours you become deconditioned in microgravity. So you've got to be able to provide this intermittent on-off, on-off, on-off exposure for short periods of time. And it's got to be a device, therefore, that is simple, friendly, user-friendly. So they would want to use it and fun. Because if it isn't fun and they have to strap themselves in and it takes 3 hours to strap themselves in and another two to unstrap themselves from the device, it's not going to work and they're not going to use it. And there's that element.
How do they keep from getting dizzy in the damn thing?
If you don't move your head.
I've heard that before. Come on.
Well, you get used to it, you know. You do get used to it.
When I took dancing lessons, they said, don't move your head and just spot and all of that. And I never could figure it out. I still was always dizzy.
We're not going to send you to Mars.
Well, and I want to go. So.
You see.
So immobilizing the head is a big plus in that. So if you have a 2-meter centrifuge, that's a little over 6 feet. So, you know, that's a lot of space you need in your crew vehicle to pull this off.
Well, I had designed one, you know. I had the patent for it because NASA wasn't interested. I'm no engineer. That's for sure. But when I was a child, I used to pump water from a cistern in our summer home. And I thought, well, and anytime I talked about a centrifuge, they said, well, it's going to take so much voltage. And I thought, well, why can't you have a human-powered centrifuge? So So I designed a very simple plate that rotates, basically, that can be driven by the person lying on it or can be driven by the guy bicycling on the side somewhere. And you can put any exercise device on it if you want, like a rower or a stepper. Or the astronaut can lie on there and spin around and have a social. And not be on it for more than 10 minutes.
And what kind of G-force would they need to go to?
Well, 2G would be plenty.
2G would be plenty.
Yeah, 2G would be plenty. 1.5G may be adequate because you're going from 0 to 1.5. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. John, do you have anything else?
I think that's about it.
Thank you for calling. Listeners, you can call us. That line is cleared. 1-866-687-7223. Or you can Skype in from your computer. The ID is The Space Show. So, Joan, you get off the centrifuge, and you start declining again because you're in microgravity.
Correct.
So let's assume I'm a couch potato sitting type of guy. So how quickly, if I get up every 15 minutes, every hour for a couple of minutes and change my position and all this, or I go for a walk for 30 minutes or whatever it may be, how quickly do I start deteriorating or having problems show up if I start returning to sitting, for example, in front of the computer?
You start deteriorating if you went back to bed, okay?
Uh-huh.
If in between you went back to bed, within 2 hours you can start seeing changes.
Within 2 hours.
Right, okay. But sitting, obviously, is milder than going to bed. So you really need to get up and move every half hour. And you can structure... You know, our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents used to move about all day, every day, no weekends off, okay? And that's what the body needs, and it needs movement in all directions, okay? Standing up is a very good stimulus. But you can structure life. I had a guy at one of my talks who put his hand up at the end of the talk and said, oh, he says, I can't do that. I can't stand up every 30 minutes. My boss would fire me. I said, what do you do? He said, well, I work with computers. I said, okay. I said, do you drink water? He said, yeah. I said, well, where do you go to a fountain? He said, oh, no, no. He said, I have a bottle on my desk. I said, great. Put the bottle on the windowsill. So that when you want to drink, you stand up and go get it. You structure your life. It's a question of making it into a habit again. You brush your teeth?
Yeah, I do brush my teeth, yeah.
Good. Well, this standing up business is like brushing your teeth. It has to become a habit. And something becomes a habit, I think in 8 weeks I've been told, but of repetition. But if you make a habit of going up and down the stairs in your building, or getting up, you know, we have a remote control for television. Before the remote, we had to get up and go change the channel. Okay, that's a nuisance.
Well, Joan, I've been sitting talking to you for a little bit more than an hour, so I've now stood up.
Good.
I'm now standing up doing the show. But seriously, something as what most of us would think would be insignificant, like standing up, is a major deal. Is that pretty much a correct understanding?
It's a major deal from the body's point of view.
Well, that's what I mean.
Yeah. From the body's point of view, it's very significant. And simple things like putting your clothes on standing up instead of sitting down to put your clothes on. You start out by leaning on something and you know, but eventually and then very rapidly. You see, the body relearns very rapidly because you've got all these wonderful brain maps and it just clicks in. When you're in space for a long time, your gravity memory goes. Your memory of gravity goes.
Here's a question for you. Carl is in Los Angeles, and he says, I go to the fitness gym 3 times a week for an hour and a half, doing both equipment and weightlifting. Does that make a difference? Does that count, or are you talking about something entirely different?
I'm talking about something different. Yes, it counts. And I think it's commendable that he goes to the gym and does these exercises. But there is a foundation. The first thing is that there is a foundation of movement that is required by the body, of small movements, a variety of movements, intermittent movements, all day, every day, weekends included. And the body doesn't know that it's a weekend or a whatever.
And holidays, no day
and
off,
holidays,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's a question of providing this foundation of small movement, small to large. You move, you wave your arms around. You brush your teeth with a, you know, we used to brush it with a regular toothbrush, and now we have an electric toothbrush.
Uh-huh.
So we've eliminated a movement. There are technologies that have entered our life. Technologies are wonderful, don't get me wrong. I love my washing machine and my vacuum cleaner and so on. But there are these technologies have robbed us of movement. And so we actually don't make the movement we used to make. Or our parents used to make. And it's a question of building back up this foundation of movement that can go from standing up and putting your clothes on, standing up, to gardening, raking the leaves that are falling now all over the place here, not in California, but, you know, raking the leaves yourself, taking a walk to the store, carrying your groceries out of the store instead of having the little guy help you, parking the car closer to the store, further from the store instead of right at the door. Going up and down the stairs in your building instead of taking the elevator. You can reintroduce movement, natural movement that your body would make in the course of a day. And it's got to be distributed throughout the day, because any time you stop for longer than 2 hours, your body starts decondition.
So taking a driving trip, you would want to stop and move around and stretch at least once every 2 hours.
Exactly. Exactly.
So here's another question from you. Paul is in Chicago, and Paul says, you'll probably think I'm a nut on this, but I have a rather large dog, and I really enjoy watching how my dog does things during a day. It appears to me that the dog knows a lot more about movement and body position than I know. It never gets up without doing some type of stretching.
Yes.
The dog, unless it's sleeping, which it does a lot during the day, gets up frequently, even if it's just to walk around the room for some reason. The dog goes up and down stairs with a real fast brace. It doesn't just barely walk up the stairs. And, of course, the dog doesn't hold on to any railings or anything. So, obviously, it has a key on its balance. I noticed the same for cats. In fact, I think cats handle movement better than dogs. Is there something in animals that allows them to do what you're talking about that we humans need to relearn?
Absolutely. You know, the practice of yoga has been based on observing nature and observing animals and observing plants, trees, swaying in the wind, and mimicking movement that is practiced by animals. Dogs, you know, there is something called the down dog position, which is basically like a dog stretches with his paws really stretched out in front. And you try and do that after a while, it's wonderful. So, yes, your dog is very clever. Also, your dog does want to get out and walk and run. It realizes that its body needs it. Something else that I've kind of toyed with. How many times do you feed your dog?
I know when I had my dog, I fed it twice a day.
Okay.
But
so why do we need to eat three times a day?
Well, some of us, maybe 10 times a day. Also, but the dog will keep eating if you keep feeding it. If you leave it to be, you know, in nature, it doesn't do that. But, I mean, if I could feed the dog an 8-ounce piece of meat or a 64-ounce piece of meat, and both of them are gone in a second. So,
maybe,
you know,
that's a bad example.
So the dog doesn't have portion control. I mean, they'll, if they're domesticated, you know, they'll eat until we quit giving them food.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, they tell you once a day or maybe one small meal either in the evening or at breakfast and then a regular meal.
Yeah.
And no snacks and no human food.
That's right. We take better care about dogs than we do ourselves sometimes.
You know, absolutely. But the vets don't know anything about what you're talking about in your book either.
No. It's so basic, you know. There's nothing fancy about it. It's common sense.
But one of the things, and this is a space show, so I'll go back a little bit to space, but we're always looking for a rationale for human spaceflight. So, as I said earlier, this argument is mostly framed in terms of bone loss and osteoporosis, which can affect older women or people with that problem here on Earth, and NASA has done a lot for helping to make inroads into that. But what you're talking about is so much more comprehensive, great grammar there. Plus, if we're really starting to deteriorate after around age 20, as our body starts changing, I mean, that's pretty alarming, because I really didn't feel the deterioration until I was a little bit over 60.
Well, yes, but now you see, it's even before then, because now kids get strokes and diabetes, and they're much more sedentary. You know, they don't go out and play in the street like we used to. Because, as you know, they're afraid of the conditions. And so PE and stuff like that are cut down in school.
Well, but most of the time, as you point out rightly in your book, most of your time in PE class is changing clothes.
That's right. Yeah. And so we have discouraged movement.
By the way, a point of clarification, your book is published, made available in December, correct?
December 1.
Okay, so for those of you who want to get it, make a note, because I have a press copy in front of me, but it will become available on December 1 of this year.
Actually, if you go on Amazon, you will already see it, and in fact it's discounted on Amazon until it gets published. So for advanced...
So you can do an advanced order.
Yeah, for an advanced order. I was amazed, but there you are. Things are changing.
Is it going to be available in the electronic e-book form, like on iBooks and things like that?
I hope so. I don't know yet, but I'm sure the publishers will do that.
Carolyn in Seattle has an email question for you. I work on losing weight, like a lot of people, and I count calories and add in the calories of the exercise I do, like riding a stationary bicycle or walking up a hill or something. Are there any noticeable calories burned by standing 15 or 20 times a day from sitting or doing just normal routine movement?
Well, yeah. Any movement you make is going to be useful. And what you want to do is get your... I don't know if you have blood sugar problems, but one of the things we saw in people, in our subjects lying in bed and in astronauts as well, is that the muscle becomes resistant to insulin, and it doesn't metabolize sugar as well. And what happens in astronauts as well as in people in bed is that as you lose muscle, fat goes in to replace the muscle. So the whole metabolism shifts towards a fat metabolizing system. And being sedentary does that.
Rita in Los Angeles, by email, is let's see if I can do this. This is why sometimes it's hard to do email. Number one, do the astronauts use electric stimulating equipment such as waistbands that pulsate?
No. We've done studies with electrical muscle stimulation. The trouble is that it stimulates a particular muscle. And short of having a whole body suit that would do that, that I don't know anyone who has done that. You know, if you want to keep the bones in your legs stimulated so that you can walk when you come back or something like that, you may want to do that. The Russians have done that sort of thing, but they're not doing it even now. No, we don't. Not routinely.
I tried it for weight loss, and we know the answer to that one. It was another waste of money gimmick. Okay, number two from Rita in Los Angeles. Does measuring bone loss occur when the astronauts are in space or when they return or both?
The bone loss is measured two ways. In space, you can get samples of blood and samples of urine that tell you that are markers of bone loss. And then, but then the big scans that are used to scan bone density and bone architecture, because it's not just density that goes. What happens in space is that the architecture of the bone changes. In other words, when you're moving around here on Earth, your tendons and your joints and your ligaments are all pulling on your bones as you move. Well, in space they don't, because your muscles are not contracting, and therefore it's not pulling on the bone. And so they go silent. And the architecture of the bone depends on what part of the bone is pulled. So it's stronger in the periphery and in certain places, like at the head of the femur, the joint. It's stronger at the joint than it is in the rest of the bone. Well, that changes. It's uniform when it comes back from space.
Is this done with a DEXA scan on Earth, or do they do?
It's a DEXA principle, but it's a really fancy a CT scan.
Because I know they use that on my son who has CF, as to measure what CF is doing to his bones.
Yeah.
And very interesting. The third part of Rita in Los Angeles' question is, assuming the average loss is 1% a month, was there great alarm when one astronaut lost 5% a month, 30% in 6 months? Did that affect the length of the astronaut's stay in space? Is there osteoporosis medication on the spaceship just in case?
The medication is not on the spaceship. They are administered the medication, as a young man said earlier, before they fly. And the idea is that before they fly, when they are healthy, they are given londrinate or bisphosphonate that stops further bone loss. So it protects the bone from being lost during the 6 months. Now, it's only just been begun, so we don't know when they come back how much they've actually, how successful it was.
Did the person who lost 30%, did that shorten their trip?
No, because he didn't know they lost 30% if he got back.
Do the Russian protocols fare better on minimizing the effects of microgravity over the NASA protocols?
It's the same.
It's the same.
But what's interesting, what's really interesting to me, is that one Apollo astronaut on the 84-day mission did not lose any bone.
How did that happen? Are you there? Did I lose you? I may have dropped the call somehow. Joan, are you there?
What that is?
Oh, I lost you for a minute.
No, it was a battery.
Oh, okay.
What that is, one Apollo astronaut lost no bone. And what that is, I believe, is that genetic predisposition comes into the equation. In other words, some of us are more predisposed to lose bone than others. Some of us have greater tendency of getting osteoporosis than others. And I believe it's very important to go back and look at some of these Apollo samples and this Apollo data. We didn't have the fancy scans, but we still have samples in the freezer where the DNA can be looked at.
So we still have that data?
We don't have the data. We have the samples.
We have the samples, okay.
Nobody's done it, as far as I know, to go in and look at their DNA and see if they have features that make them resistant to bone loss. Because then, I mean, I don't know if NASA would do that, but you could select, say you're going for a two-year mission to Mars. Hello, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah. You're going into your mission to Mars, well, I would like to select people who have a lesser tendency to lose bone, wouldn't you?
That would make sense also if there were people that were presupposed to not be impacted by radiation.
Absolutely, and that does exist. I mean, the technique. They know exactly which gene they have to look at and so on. That can be done. In fact, when I was at headquarters, I used to advocate for that, and they thought I was heretic. But
so again, what I don't get is you have all of these people pontificating within NASA and in the space enthusiast and the advocacy world and all these space companies. We're going to Mars. We're going to Deimos. We're doing this. We're doing that. Dr. Zubrin says we can do it in 10 years. Others say we'll go in 2033 with the optimum launch window. I mean, you know, it's all over the board. And nobody wants to do this kind of core work to find out exactly what type of person is best suited to do this to survive the damn mission. They do talk about crew size and emotional stability.
Yes.
I've done a lot of programming on that, but nobody is getting into the nitty-gritty like you're talking about. I don't understand how you can take them seriously if they don't start addressing this and if they have research samples available that can possibly provide great information. It's a hell of a lot cheaper to do these tests than it is to build a rocket to nowhere.
David, you're touching a core here. Very important. First of all, I've written, you know, reviews and op-eds and things.
No, I know, and I get your newsletter, and listeners, all of you should go to her website, and I'll put that information in the archives and get her newsletter, and read her other books, and listen to the show she was on a couple of years ago when her other book was published.
But there are four things that need to be solved before we start considering what damn rocket we're going to build.
In my view, too. Well, I concur. I mean,
because they're long lead time items. They are very long lead time. How long does it take a drug to go from research to market? It takes 20 years.
And that's assuming it works.
And that's assuming it works, exactly. And it's going to take at least 20 years of serious, systematic, consistent, continuous research. Focused research, not say going to universities and saying, what would you like to do? Or what question would you like to ask? Okay? Research that could have been on space station when we had the shuttle to take things up and down. And we didn't do it for a variety of political reasons. We now don't have the shuttle. We have no animals to do research. We can do it on little creatures, you know, we can get enough information. What we can do on astronauts is great, but it's limited. We should be doing a lot of ground research, but focused ground research, not one thing at a time, but systematic, one thing after another, like we did in Mercury, Gemini, Apollo. I mean, there was a systematic sequence of events. And with every mission, we learned a little more. And it was cumulative. And that's the kind of program we need. Now, as you know very well, since I left NASA, I have not been replaced.
I lost you again. Joan, can you hear me? Hello? I may have lost her for good this time.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I thought I lost you again.
You
have not been replaced in your position.
My position does not exist. And the programs in the mid 2005 thereabouts was abolished, supposedly to contribute to the funding of Orion and Constellation. Well, I mean, it was a drop in the ocean. I mean, you couldn't buy stamps for the program with what the life sciences budget was. We have no life support system that can take us to Mars. Forget the medical. I think we can solve the medical. I know enough that I think we can solve the medical. In spite of all the things I've said and the problems, I think we can solve it. Because I'm beginning, you know, once you begin to understand what the body sees and what you need to give, replace in the body, you're halfway there. But life support is a total unknown, in the sense that we have no closed life support system. There is no way to resupply on the way to Mars, and there's no way to resupply on Mars. So what are you going to do? How are you? I don't care how many rockets you send up and you develop. If you don't have a closed life support system, you're nowhere. You're nowhere.
Well, again, there are people who say we don't need it, and they dismiss it.
We don't need it. What are they going to do? You know, Jim Bajan said to me one time, he says, when I'm up there, the first thing I worry about is, can I breathe? Well, you know, it comes down to that. We don't need it. Why? Because we think we know how to do it. Neither the Russians nor we have a closed life support system. And thank God for the Chinese. One of these days, they're going to come up with something like that, except they tend to copy us. So my hope isn't great. But now there are wonderful ways of, for instance, water purification without filters. Unheard of. Solar energy that can... we have the solar panels for the space station, but what about for everything else in the space station? And the life support system. We're still working with whatever it is we were, fuel cells. And lithium canisters. I mean, it is archaic and narrow-minded. If we want to explore, we need to all sit down and say, okay, what are the shortfalls? What do we need to start now so that we know what progress we have made in 10 years, and we are ready in 20 years to send someone else?
Is it a function of throwing money at it, or...
No.
So
it's a function of throwing brains at it. And will, and to get to be allowed to have a program that has the continuity and stability of continuous support at a level that and designed to encourage collective thinking of the best brains we have. I mean, during World War II, you know, they used to gather these people and say, okay, look, we've got malaria problem, or we've got an infection problem. You know, that's how antibiotics got discovered, and how anti-malarials got discovered, and so on. It was a fantastic time. You know, how did the atomic bomb get created? They got the brains and they sat them down in the Manhattan Project and said, okay, you guys, we're going to stay in here until you come up with something. And if it's going to be a project and we're serious about it, it is not just funding places for jobs. I'm out of it and I can say anything I want. But unfortunately, when two congressmen or two senators are designing the next launch system, I shall worry. Okay, so they get help from good brains and recommendations. But, I mean, it is preposterous. Because somebody wants this thing built, and it happens to be built in X state, in X whatever, for these jobs not to be let go. We have to use old technology. You know, instead of thinking the logical questions, what is it we want to do, how quickly, I mean... Zubin, in his own way, is creative. There are scramjet technologies out there being developed that can change the face of the whole space business. Bigelow has to fire half his manpower because he can't get up to any space station that he...
Yeah, there's no rides available. And exactly. None on the horizon because they're so bogged down.
The station has to be used, but we can't use it because we can't get 50% of the space station, U.S. space station, is going unused for research because we have no way of getting up there. And we don't have the right equipment to begin with because it never went. I mean, it was cut off.
When you were at NASA, did you speak like this or were you much more politically correct?
I was slightly more politically correct, but I always expressed my view. Sometimes it got me into a lot of trouble. But, you know, somebody has to tell them. They knew it. But, you know, it certainly couldn't tell to, you know, the politicians that I tell their stuff. It didn't make me beloved.
I want to go back to your book for a moment because you have really... interesting information here that listeners are not going to ever find anyplace else. Like you've got on page 75 a table that shows the G benefits of popular sports. Now, where in the hell, listeners, are you going to find this? Skateboarding, snowboarding, surfing, skating, skiing. So the G benefit is acceleration, balance and coordination, strength, stamina. Walking, hiking, mountain, and climbing, impact loading, acceleration, stamina, strength. I mean, swimming, diving, fly fishing, stamina, coordination,
yes.
Strength, gentle on the joints. You're not going to find this anyplace. Do you have golf listed? A lot of people play golf.
I think golf is in there somewhere. Golf is very important because it depends on using gravity. But some of those, of course, are speculative on my part. But some, there is data, like a trampoline, for instance. Jumping on a trampoline has been studied and with accelerometers on the legs so that you know what it is. The other thing that I think people will be interested in is like the standing up. I have a star rating for different activities, if you noticed, and depending on how you use gravity. And, for instance, standing up consumes about 15 calories. But it's a 5-star rated gravity using activity. So it's not about using calories.
You have another table that I really liked, comparison of times and seconds that mm-hmm. men and women of different ages can hold various weights in pounds with an
yes.
outstretched dominant arm at shoulder height. If Dr. Jurist is listening and he keeps calling me an old geezer at 65, I think this would probably validate what he's talking about. So between 65 and 80, a 3-pound weight would be 90 to 140 seconds for an average guy.
Yeah, and you know you know some of these people that I used in my test.
Well, you didn't give their names, but
no, I didn't give them.
You actually have a plan. To say a workout plan might be incorrect, right? But you actually have a sort of a daily G habit, non-exercise activity list in your book. I don't want you to give it away because I'd like people to buy your book. It's much more than just this. But you talk about standing up, sitting down, blood pressure control, stretching. And I mean, can you sort of just mention a little bit about what your activity plan is per day?
Well, it's the variety. And I mean, the basics are variety, intermittent, both intense and mild, whole body, all parts of you. For instance, holding your neck up. You know, a baby is born, they can't hold their head up.
Right.
So they have to strengthen their neck muscles to support their head. Okay. As we age, one of the things that goes, especially with sitting, is that those muscles weaken and our head droops. And you see people walking as you get older, and their head is hanging forward. Okay, so you're looking at your feet, which doesn't help. But maintaining your head up is not only good for balance and posture, but it's also healthy in terms of swallowing and digestion and a whole bunch of other things. Simple things like that that come from observation is phenomenal. The getting dressed and undressed standing up. Well, what a revelation. It's not that difficult. You can do it. And squatting. Squatting, if you can do it, is wonderful. If you keep doing it, you'll get to do it. It's a question of...
I'm losing you again on your phone. I guess your battery is petering out. Are you there? She'll come back in a second. Joan, are you there, or did we lose you for good?
And it's just
No, we lost you again in a minute. So you want to repeat what you just said, please?
I said it's a question of, the getting dressed and undressed, standing up, and all the variety of little movements you do, reaching up to pick up a jug from a shelf, carrying your groceries bags to the car, or holding a baby is all weight training, basically. You go to the gym and use a machine instead. But you can do these things throughout the day, all day, intermittently, and they become habits again so that you don't think about them, you just do them.
Very, very interesting. So Rita has another set of questions for you. I know, can you stay an extra couple of minutes?
Sure.
Okay, so let me see if I can pick them up. In their research, in NASA's research on osteoporosis, to what extent does NASA actually involve doctors who specialize in osteoporosis? And in addition, I would think that, do they consult with doctors in this field? And then she says, I would think that the pharmacy companies would be very eager to be involved and to assist in this situation. Is there an interest on the drug companies in this kind of research?
Absolutely. And the doctors are the leading experts in the country, are working on these.
They work with NASA.
On all the issues, but on bone in particular, and that's why we've made this progress. But also because NASA has had this problem, as you said earlier, osteoporosis clinically has benefited. So, we developed the ways, the DEXA, the ways of measuring bone density, all that was NASA developed.
Do you have a lot of hope? How do you think our future, the next 5 or 7 years in space, is going to unfold for human spaceflight and the issues we've talked about today?
I always hope. And I work quite a bit with the European Space Agency. And there are some fantastic young scientists I work with. And we're coming up with a theory that what underlies the changes in it is an increase in inflammation and a shift to an acid, greater acidity in the body. And in fact, they're testing baking soda. I hate to say this, but it's basic. Except instead of sodium bicarbonate, they use potassium bicarbonate so they don't pump you with a lot of sodium. And there is a study going on, a bed rest study, using potassium bicarbonate to examine its effect on bone loss. Because it is believed that the acidity in the body, for some reason, acidity increases as a function of inactivity, as a function of sitting. So does inflammation. And that the bone loss and everything else are related to or the result of this acidity. And if you neutralize this acidity somehow with a baking soda or potassium bicarbonate, that you should theoretically be able to prevent it. And so it's a fascinating, you know, simple solution if it's true and works for a lot of people here on Earth, all of us who worry about our bones, and certainly for the astronauts. It's a whole lot better than turning your bones into cement.
Absolutely. So if we have an acid stomach or reflux on Earth, mm-hmm. and we treat that with, you know, there's all sorts of ways to treat that.
Yeah.
Does that make a difference on what you're talking about, or in this instance, space would be very different?
No, I think it makes a difference. There was a doctor, in fact, he was at the Loma Linda.
In Los Angeles, yeah.
Yeah. And he, Baylink was his name, and he had found that Tums, you know Tums?
Yeah, Tums is one, uh-huh.
Right. Tums would help prevent bone loss. And that's a long time ago, and you know, so it was shelved somewhere. And
well, that's calcium carbonate.
Well, it's calcium carbonate, okay, but that also, okay, so it had the calcium connotation, but it's the carbonate that was the interesting part.
So that's like the catalyst that makes it all come together.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting. Well, I know that for people I know that have bone loss issues, they take something like Tums or Oscal, which is calcium carbonate.
Right. Yeah.
You know,
the
doctors tell them that it's the calcium carbonate form that they want to be taking.
That's correct. Yeah.
Not something else.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
What's next? Are you going to do another book? Do you still go out and speak?
Oh, I go out and speak. I do public speaking. Yeah, invite me for talks, anyone, anywhere. I've spoken to all kinds of people, and it's fascinating. And I usually go back because they want me to go back. But that as soon as this book gets published, I hit the road and. I go and speak wherever anyone wants me. They can go to my website and find out.
What is your website address?
My website is Dr. Joan. Sorry. My website is joanvernikos.com.
Okay. Do you have another book in mind after this one?
Oh, yes.
Can you
see, my other life and my original research and the reason I was hired by NASA was for stress. And I had done stress research on how the brain regulates the response to stress before I ever went to NASA. I was at Ohio State University teaching medical students, and they recruited me from there because they figured that putting a person on top of a rocket was going to be stressful. What turned out was that the original seven, bless their hearts, when they went into space, not a trace of it. Before and after, yes. But while they were in space, the first time we measured it in Gemini 7, in fact, they were relieved of stress. I mean, this was fun for them. These were people who had been in the Korean War and in Vietnam and whatever, fighter pilots. This was gravy. So the original astronauts were not stressed one bit, and I thought, well, here's the end of the career. But as we've progressed, obviously, especially with the younger folks that we hire now that are not the military, many of them, there's a lot of stress, and there's a lot of stress in staying longer and having more people involved.
Well, a book with stress and moving together would be great for all of us couch potatoes out here.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, it's the combination of stress being the foundation. If you manage stress, you get rid of a lot of your problem, of medical problems. And then movement, and then sleep, and obviously didn't touch on. And then the gravy is what you eat.
It's easier to stay in denial, Joan.
Yes.
Listeners, again, her book, which will be available December 1, although you can do an advanced order, and she says it's at a discount on Amazon.com, Sitting Kills, Moving Heals, How Simple Everyday Movement Will Prevent Pain, Illness, and Early Death, and Exercise Alone Won't. And you can spell her name, V-E-R-N-I-K-O-S. And I would urge each and every one of you to get the book and to pay attention to what she has been talking about today in terms of what's needed to have safe, long-duration human spaceflight. And I hope to have you back on the show much sooner than a number of years again. And we will stay in touch. And best of luck with your book and the holidays coming up. And you have a lot to say, and I hope you get before a big Amway convention of 100,000 people or something. you know, something really huge that where people will listen. And I'm going to actually show your book to my doctor when I go back to him next time.
Good.
And tell him he ought to give it to all of his patients. He won't do it, but I'm going to make that suggestion.
It's a little book. It's not.
No, I know. It's a little book. And I'm going to tell him he ought to give it to all of his patients, and he ought to at least put a damn copy of it in his waiting room.
Thank you, David.
Any closing comments, any pearls of wisdom you'd like to leave with listeners today?
Stay well, stand up, use gravity.
Okay. Until the next time, Joan, thank you very much for being a guest on the Space Show today.
Thank you very much, David. I'd love to come back.
Okay. And listeners, that's it for today. Tomorrow, the Futron Corp is on, and we're going to talk about the Space Competitive Index. The U.S. is still doing well, but we have slipped, and the trend is not in the right direction. You don't want to miss that show. Thank you all for listening to today's Space Show, and make friends with gravity and use it, everybody. Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.